NPR News, I'm Danielle Carson in Washington.
The president of Syria is expected to address his nation soon to announce he's lifting an emergency law that gave security forces broad powers to arrest and detain anyone deemed a threat to the government. Bashar al-Assad has also accepted the cabinet's resignation. The U.S. Supreme Court will not stop the execution of an Arizona death row inmate who is due to die by lethal injection soon. Today, the high court declined to review a lower court's decision to deny a stay of execution for Eric John King. The 47-year-old is scheduled to be executed 10 a.m. local time at the state prison in Florence. He's accused of killing two people during a 1989 robbery. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of 28,800 rubber duck bath toys that were lost at sea, and what one writer learned about the ocean and ocean junk when he tried to trace them. We hear from Donovan Hone, the author of Moby Duck. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson, our producer, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this hour, we're going to the archives for a past Focus show. So that means that in this hour, we'll not be taking calls. The host on this particular program, Celeste Quinn.
A few years back, at the age of 44, radio producer and video journalist Tom Jokinen quit his job with the CBC in order to work as an apprentice for a family-owned funeral home. He was curious about what happens between the time of death and the day we're buried. In his words, he wanted to get a closer look at what I may be fated to never figure out. Why do we do what we do when someone dies? And how do we handle the leftovers? This morning, we'll take a look at how we deal with the recently deceased. We'll also talk about the changes the funeral industry has undergone and what changes lie on the horizon. Tom Jokinen examines those issues and more in the book Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. Among the programs our guest, Tom Jokinen, worked on for the CBC were Morningside, and definitely not the opera. He's also worked as a railroad operator and an editorial cartoonist, and somewhere along the way, he spent 2 years in medical school. In 2006, he became an apprentice undertaker at a funeral home and crematorium in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Tom, it's good to talk with you. How are you?
Hi, fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine as well. So was this a journalistic endeavor, or did you think this might be a new career?
It could have gone either way, I think, but it was intended as a journalistic project. I had done a documentary for CBC Television on what I saw as some of the more unusual commercial trends in what they call modern death care, the funeral industry, driven for the most part by the rise in cremation. It just changed the way people view the process of dealing with the dead, and also what's inevitably been happening over decades or generations is less and less attachment to religious traditions or any tradition. So I just felt that there was more to be said about this strange, bizarre world than you can get at in a brief documentary. And I became kind of obsessed with it to the point where one of the characters in the doc, there was a funeral director named Neil Bardell in Winnipeg, I approached him with the idea of working for him rather than just observing his routine and his world, to actually live it for a chunk of time, and he agreed. So I went to work as an apprentice in his funeral home for about a year, quit my job at CBC to do this. I wonder if it's something. In the end, I think I had to decide, was I doing this as a participant to tell the story, or as a participant to actually see if this was something that I wanted to do with my life, and I opted for the former. I think because I just wasn't a particularly good pretend undertaker. it was just a journalistic project in the end.
Yeah. Also, I wonder if this wasn't a project you embarked upon because you had some questions about the big questions in life.
Absolutely. I worked a lot of years in radio and television, and there's some advantage to kind of swooping into a story, saying your bit, and then flying out and doing it again the next day. You get a taste of a lot of what modern living and is all about: politics, sociology, psychology. It's a smorgasbord. But I just found I was hungry for something bigger. And no question, I've been touched by people dying close to me, and was struck not just by the ritual or lack of ritual that goes along with it, but also this central question: what do we do? How do we face it? How do other people deal with us when we're in grief? Is there an advantage to simply buying your way out of it? Is there any advantage to the kind of ritual, some of which is meaningful, some of which is cockeyed, that we turn to in a time of crisis? These were big questions, and Edward Albee says there's really only two things worth writing about: life and death. And I guess I had to start somewhere.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you state in the book, funeral homes are built like theaters. And funeral homes resemble homes, but you say, they're built like theaters. Later in the book, you were told by someone the modern ritual needs a taste of showbiz.
Yeah. Well, look, how did we do it years ago? It started, the ritual had always been something that families did, people did for each other, following some sort of religious script, or certainly something that we did for each other in small group, community groups, families. Somebody was dying, they often died at home. Or if they died by, in some accident, an industrial accident, or through a catastrophic illness, they were taken home to be dealt with by the family, and then the family in the community would wash and prepare them and build a casket and walk it to the graveyard and bury it. Somewhere along the line came the opportunity to subcontract that process out to a private contractor. For better or worse, that's where it's been ever since. The funeral home started as a kind of a version, an imitation, a simulacrum of the normal home, the home that you lived in, that where you used to wake the dead. And then it just got more and more elaborate. So, yeah, there's an element of display and production. Look, they call the guy the funeral director, and when you sit in a chapel in a funeral home, there's rows of seats that are aimed at a kind of stage that's well lit, and the central star of the production has been given makeup and a particular costume, and the lighting has been adjusted just so, and there's a certain expectation of a three-act structure. It's very theatrical, and that's because ritual, the way religion saw it, has evolved secularly into something closer to entertainment.
Mm. In the end, does it come down to our need for story and meaning?
Oh, absolutely. And this is not I'm not saying all this as a critique necessarily, because there's great power in story and narrative and ritual. It's just when you're... And I didn't even, in doing this, I guess I kind of wound up with some sort of nostalgia for the old religious way. And I didn't, I had no idea that I was so conservative. You know, it was an odd discovery on my part to think, wow, maybe there was some value in a kind of religious ritual of a community coming together to say goodbye to somebody and applying some meaning to what is otherwise an absolutely meaningless, irrational, hopeless event, and that's the loss of somebody completely disappearing out of your life and off the planet, bang, gone. How do you deal with that? Personally, it's almost impossible to deal with. As a group, as a community, to come together and have an event, well, you can start to see where that contributes to healing in some way. Mm. So, yeah, I don't know that it's a bad thing that it is borrowing something from entertainment because it has lost something in its connection to old religious traditions. Somehow, we find a need to sit down with a group and remark on the fact that somebody's gone and to do it in a way that makes sense. And usually the way that we do that is to, tell the life story or tell a story.
Yeah. And it's also very much about comforting those who are left behind.
Some would say that's the only reason to have a funeral. Mm-hmm. If you've given up the idea that you need to incant a certain series of prayers or hymns or whatever in order to launch the deceased onto their next journey, then the only reason to have this ritual is for the sake of the people left behind. So, unfortunately, we also are in a time where science kind of answers important questions for us. Nobody has been able to determine whether these kind of things are helpful, whether they give us this mystical notion of closure. It's not something that's been closely studied. It's all anecdotal. And this gives the industry a ton of room to make pronouncements about things that are so, good for us. It sounds reasonable to invest a certain amount of money into a casket or a PowerPoint presentation or a burial in a cemetery with a headstone because that's the way it's always been done. But nobody's been able, we don't have the benefit of studies or anything like that to suggest that this is necessary for our getting over it. We kind of just go along with the way things have always been done. And that's a huge opportunity for commerce to come up with solutions for us, and they have.
This is Focus, our guest in this portion of the program. Journalist Tom Jokinen, author of Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with questions, comments. You can join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You may also join us by email. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call now from a listener waiting for us in Charleston on line one. Hello.
Hello. What a day to listen to your program because I just buried my sister today. My question is to the writer. Does writing this book help you handle death better?
Does writing the book help me deal with loss or death?
Loss, yes, because, when you lose somebody, there are so many things that come to mind. You're trying to find comfort. For me, this is the first time I've had a young person, in my family die. Mm-hmm. So even though I could not attend the funeral, I feel like it's a big loss to me not being able to attend because I couldn't attend because of safety reasons in southern Nigeria. I cannot go there right now.
Yeah.
But I just feel like it's a big loss not being able to be there.
Right.
So, I don't know. I still think that funerals are a way to find a closure.
Right.
And actually, I never felt that way until that privilege of not being to my sister's funeral was taken away from me, because of the situation in Nigeria. So now I can look at it in a different way. So what do you think?
Mm. Well, I'm very sorry about your sister, first of all. It's complicated, and, you know, I'm not, I'm a journalist, so I don't pretend to have any authority on psychology or, you know, what helps and what doesn't, except for what I've been exposed to anecdotally in the time that I spent amongst people that go through loss. And I think the best way to say it, I think, is that, yeah, there is some comfort in a ritual, a funeral, but it's not the only comfort available. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in some cases, and I've certainly encountered people that didn't have the option to go for the same, sounds like the same sort of reason as what you're facing. It was either too far away, it happened in another country, they didn't have the resources to attend a funeral, and they were stuck. It's just separating out this idea. The loss. It is one way of addressing the loss, but it's not the only one. And this idea that there are, for example, five stages of grief, or you need to see the body to know that it's really gone, or you need to hear the music of a funeral, or you need to hear Psalm 23, that these things are like a checklist that you have to achieve in order to get closer to getting past the loss. Well, it is more complicated than that, and you are going to find ways to confront and comfort yourself with the help of friends and family outside of this simple act of attending a funeral. It's going to take time, but it's possible, I think, and to do more than just attend an event.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just about the funeral. The funeral can help, but it's sort of limiting to think that it's the only way to confront grief.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for the call this morning. Other calls are invited, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, tell us more about this man that you went to work for, Neil Burdell, and his funeral home, and maybe you could describe for us some of the conversations you had with him about these kinds of issues.
Yeah. Well, he's a fascinating guy, and he came from a funeral tradition. You know, his father was an undertaker, his grandfather was an undertaker, his grandfather was an Icelandic immigrant to Manitoba, which is a western prairie province in Canada. You know, it's just up the Red River from North Dakota. And his grandfather was the first embalmer in that part of Canada. So, I mean, we're talking funeral royalty. And the way he described it when he was an apprentice is they basically embalmed everything that came through the door. There was really no option. I mean, people always did things the same way. They'd embalm the body, put it in a casket, view it at a viewing, and then have a funeral some, you know, day or so later, and then bury it in a cemetery. You know, bang, that's the way things were done. And it wasn't until he matured, started getting older as an undertaker and starting to ask questions and starting to see how his world was changing around him. For example, it was after the publication of Jessica Mitford's famous book, The American Way of Death, which asked, pointed and serious questions about why we were spending so much money on this made-up tradition, why the funeral industry was getting away with soaking widows for all the benefit money that they earned, you know, as a result of somebody's death, and advocating cremation as a fresher, cleaner, cheaper alternative. Did Neil start to ask the same questions of his own business? And it was hard going for him because there was basically so much more money to be had in the old embalming and burial business. But he had to ask of his own industry, what are we? Are we people responsible for helping families deal with loss, and first and foremost for dealing with the physical fact of death, of dealing with the body, or are we pot and pan salesmen, you know, where our business is the more expensive casket, the more expensive urn, the more expensive doodads and gewgaws that go with the new funeral. And he opted to show himself in his community as the cremation option. You know, they called him the bake and shaker because, you know, his way was the simpler way. And he thought right up to his death, which was, you know, just earlier this year, that was the way the baby boomers would see things, not elaborate, that despite their famous self-interest, that the 75 million strong in North America baby boomer demographic, which is about to hit this industry, would choose a simpler way rather than a more complicated, elaborate way, and that was through cremation and people figuring out their own rituals on their own without the funeral industry. So he stuck to that, and I think it really separated from him from his colleagues, and he took a lot of heat from his colleagues. But it made, for me, it was an absolutely fascinating way to see how it was possible to do things differently in that context.
Mm. Was it ever a question that he would go into this line of work? Because he came up as a, as you mentioned, a funeral royalty.
Oh, you mean could he have done something else?
Yeah. Or, did, or
well, you know, that's the funny thing about family business. His father made it clear to him that this is what he was going to do with his life.
Hmm.
And then when his own sons, Neil's own sons, he has two. One is a funeral director, and one isn't. And Eric, his eldest son, who now runs the business, he did everything. He worked in construction. He was a ski bum in Whistler. He fished on Lake Winnipeg professionally. He went from job to job to job, but eventually the call was too loud for him. You know, he said, it was inevitable I'd wind up in this racket. And you know, his other son, his youngest son, used to work in the funeral home on summers, but he decided early on that he wasn't going to heed the call, and so far he hasn't been dragged into it yet. But it's really tough, I think, when it's the family business to do anything but, certainly in this family's experience.
Let's take another call now. This is another listener in Charleston on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. Last spring at the local Ebert Film Festival, I saw the Japanese film Departures about the practice there. I guess literally the translation is encoffinment, where they go to the home of the deceased, and they actually, in the presence of the family and close friends, clean and dress the body. And it's the filming of it, at least, was very, very beautiful. It was almost like tea ceremony, the ritual they went through, and they do it in such a delicate way. The body, of course, is done on tatami mat floor where the rest of the family is, but it's a very, very fascinating. It's not technically ritual in the sense that there are no prayers or anything said, but I think it takes that on. Are you aware of this film? Have you seen it?
I have, and I haven't seen it. It's funny that you should mention it, because I was just at a couple of writers festivals in Australia, and every second person that I spoke to asked if I'd seen Departures, and I kept promising people I was going to see it. It's eluded me so far, but I feel like I have seen it because it's come up, and it's obviously struck a chord. I'm fascinated with this idea, although conflicted. Well, I feel when it comes to this subject, I'm conflicted of just about everything. It's almost impossible to hold an absolute ironclad opinion about what's right and what's wrong. And certainly when I was doing some research on the book in California, where there is, compared to anywhere else in the U.S., a slightly more active movement towards the home funeral, the do-it-yourself, that people are trying to win back ownership of ritual away from industry and to bring it back home. to do what Neil Bardell used to call a version of the village model, taking care of your own dead rather than, you know, because what you deal with in the modern industry is somebody dies and then they disappear as if down a black hole for a period of days or a week. And then
That's the feeling I have more and more now when I attend even visitations. Oftentimes there's, you know, photographs and videos, but there's no body, no coffin, and I guess I'm old enough that it does feel like the person's disappeared down a black hole and there's no opportunity to sort of face up to the reality of what happened.
Okay, there's two things on this, and because I think there's great value in the impulse to take some ownership and some control of it, especially away from people that are complete strangers that are doing it for the money. Now, I say that with a couple of caveats. One is, despite the stereotypes that we bring, and my experience in the funeral business did a lot to open my eyes, despite the stereotypes that we can bring to the funeral industry, there are a great number of people in my experience who work and are genuine caregivers, and that they will take care of your family for you, and you can trust them, despite the fact that there are plenty of bad apples who are only after your bank account and will rip you off. They are out there, but you know, when I say things are complicated, it's that you can find a funeral director without too much effort who will take care of your family rather than abuse them. So there's that. The other thing is, having the experience working in a funeral home, is the danger of over-romanticizing this process of taking care of your own dead. The dead are physically complicated things. They're cold and they're ugly. They make a mess. They are not like they appear in the movie Departures. However, as long as people accept that, and, you know, frankly, a lot of people deal with their family members when they're ill and not at their best, so it's not a big jump to deal with the body, but it's important to remember that poetry exists only in film and literature, and that death is an ugly, 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 messy thing, as long as you're prepared for confronting your loved ones in that context. It's important not to have a veil over your eyes. So as long as you have all those things in place, I think it's a great step forward for us as a culture to see people that want to take control of it. But they need to know what they're getting into.
Does a listener want to follow up? I think the caller has hung up. This is Focus. Our guest this morning, Tom Jokinen. He's a journalist, and he is the author of Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. He worked for a year as an apprentice in a funeral home in Winnipeg, Canada. Well, what do the people who care for the recently deceased want us to know about them and what they do and why they do it?
Well, I figured, and I don't think I'm wrong about this, I figure a lot of them don't want you to know. You know, I lucked into Neil Bardell, who decided that it was about time to open up his mysterious world. I mean, that's why I call the book Curtains, because it is a look, and there's an implication with curtains that you're really not supposed to be looking back there. They're there, they're closed for a reason. The majority, in my experience, of people that work in the industry are happy to work quietly in the background, doing what they do, and on the assumption that we simply don't want to know, that we don't want to confront death, and we don't want to know about the physical fact of it, and we don't want to know what bodies do after they're dead, and we don't want to know what cremation means or what it looks like or what happens. That said, I think and it's hard to generalize, but I think a lot of people in the industry are still stinging from the 40, now 40-plus-year-old, almost 50-year-old image that Jessica Mitford put out there of somebody who has invented a ritual in order to create income. I don't know if that's still the case, that people are suspicious of their undertaker, but most of the news that you read about undertakers are the ones that are running off with the pre-need trust fund, or are digging up bodies in the cemetery to make room for fresh ones, and thereby double selling property. I don't know that they're any more hard done by than any other group that tends to get heat socially, like lawyers and journalists. Undertakers are often seen as in it for the cash, and some of them are.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, for example, I met a young undertaker who she had worked with seniors in a senior's home, and she found that the thing that families told her that was the most difficult in dealing with the death of an elderly parent or grandparent was dealing with the funeral home, that she decided to switch sides, and that's how she became an undertaker, is she figured she could be as much help or possibly more help on the other side as she was taking care of them when they were alive. So she saw a great need there. But she saw herself as somebody who would help families rather than as a saleswoman.
Hmm. Let's take another call now. This is a listener in Indiana on line 4. Hello.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm just traveling down the road, and I was listening to you, and I had a few thoughts. Reading the Bible, you know, Jesus said we'd born here, but the time would come when we'd last. And I always thought that was interesting, but there's a time and a place for everything. But I really think that's a wonderful thought that God is he's involved in laughter, but not right now. But I was wondering, in the funeral industry, I always wonder about the funeral directors and people, where they see humorous things, and yet they have to keep a straight face, and, you know, they have to be very serious. I wonder if there's anything that could be said about that.
You know, it's a workplace. I mean, like any other. You know, I've spent time in the embalming room with a chief embalmer who, a woman in her 20s, and as we're performing this procedure of replacing the blood in a human body with chemical, talking about the color scheme that she's working on for her house, and she was decorating in a kind of red and black and African theme, and it struck me what an odd conversation to have in an embalming room. But you know, it's a workplace. It's in a lot of ways no different than working in a factory. There's a certain routine to it. You know, they all have stories about opening the casket at a viewing and having the family say, well, that's not the right body, and reassuring them, yes, well, that's really the way that some families react, and the body always looks different, you know, after it's not as in pain anymore, and so on, and being told, no, really, that's not the right body. These kind of things happen all the time, and they tell them as if they're war stories. It's important to maintain a sense of humor. There's no environment that I've encountered where it was more necessary to maintain a sense of humor, because otherwise you go mad dealing with death every day.
And there is such a thing as funeral director fatigue syndrome.
Well, yeah, there's, I kind of ironically thumbed through my share of self-help books about by industry insiders about how to deal with slumping sales and industry trends and sociology and psychology. And, there's an assertion that, pay attention to your own symptoms. Are you feeling depressed? Are you feeling unappreciated? Do you feel immune to the emotional pressures of your day-to-day job? And coining the phrase funeral director fatigue syndrome as if it were a disease, as if it were anything different than what most people face in their workday, which is just simply being misunderstood and getting sick of it. Funny that it has to have a name. But, look, there's a routine to it. I often found I'd go into work, you know, I'd have to go out and pick up a body, bring it back to the funeral home for cremation or embalming, you know, one or the other, hopefully not mixing them up because, you know, mistakes are kind of frowned upon in that industry. They're not reversible. Dealing with 5-6 bodies a day and then getting ready to go home at 5 o'clock and thinking, wow, there are like 5 or 6 people in Winnipeg who are drawing breath right now. But by the time I come to work in the morning, they won't be. Mm-hmm. And I'll encounter them as I do every day. It can drain you, what's required is a certain perspective of what it is you do and for whom, and a little bit of a hard coding.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Lovington, line 1. Hello.
Well, this may be a little bit redundant, but I'm always kind of impressed by the decorum of the funeral directors, the attitude they carry. That it always seems to me like they're kind of the ones that I know that. Of course, I'm in a small town, and pretty much every funeral I go to is the same people. But it seems like all the funeral directors that where I go to a funeral and meet somebody at the door, they're always kind of, you know, waiting to take a cue from you, and they're kind of open and are kind of open for whatever comes at them, and I'm pretty impressed by that.
Yeah, I wasn't prepared to be this way. I mean, I got such a kick out of Jessica Mitford's book, and it was so beautifully written and hilarious and spot on, you know, in line with my politics about commerce and big business. But, you know, I went to work for a family funeral home. It wasn't one of the big conglomerates, and there are several that run chains, you know, thousands of funeral homes and cemeteries owned by one company out of Texas or Des Moines or California, they save money through economies of scale. You know, 5 or 6 local funeral homes in a city would use one embalming facility or one, you know, or share a fleet of cars and sell packages according to a sales plan that, you know, a 21-year-old fresh out of embalming school undertaker would take into the arrangement room and work off a checklist. You know, those sort of the same pitfalls that any large corporation brings to the table but for a family funeral home, especially in a small community, yeah, there is this sense that they are part of that community and they have a different context and their survival depends on them understanding their community and not just turning over one funeral after another, like some of the corporate chains tend to do in order to gain not a connection with people, but to gain shareholder value. So it was really an eye-opening for me to work with a family funeral home to see that rather than being kind of a despised or suspicious character in the community, people really looked up to Neil and saw him as a real important part of their community. You know, Jane Jacobs, in writing about community, said that, you know, just like the pharmacist or the drugstore owner or the policeman or the fireman, that the undertaker has a place in his community if he understands that.
Does a listener want to follow up?
They almost seem like they're kind of like a counselor or something, you know, at that time. You know, they're pretty much, you go to they don't seem to be having any problems of their own, and you know they're there for everybody. You know, they got you walk in, and they got a pleasant demeanor, and it's always that way. And you know, if you're upset, they're ready for that. If you're like, you know, he sure was a good old boy. How about, you know, the time he did that? They're ready for that. You know, it's just they're pretty. It seems to me like they're really stable people, for one thing.
Some of them are. Some of them aren't. I mean, I don't want to go too far in the other direction because I have met, and many listeners will have met, funeral directors who are just simply jerks, yeah. You know, as you do in any profession.
Yeah.
And the thing is, and something people may not think of is like in any other area of commerce, you can refuse to work with jerks. And I think we're all, most of us are decent enough judges of human nature that we can spot a jerk after a couple of minutes of conducting business with them. It's not a taboo, nor is it impossible to take your business elsewhere, even when you're dealing with a dead loved one. Sometimes I think because we think it's such a complicated taboo world that we kind of have to go with the first person that we sit down with. But in fact, it is sanctioned, possible, and welcome to be able to shop around if you end up dealing with somebody who you just don't get along with.
Yeah. In my life experience, I have seen somebody who did it very well and someone who we were out the door.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Right.
And so, yeah, you have that power.
Yes.
Yep. And I think the other thing is I think that funeral homes that are not providing what is needed and wanted, if you're never going to call them again, you know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, no, it's what it should be, what the market will bear. And if you're an idiot and a bad funeral director and you take advantage of people and you don't care about repeat business, you care about volume. At some point, if people accept that they have the power of being a consumer to take that business away from you, then you're going to go out of business. It's that still at this point, because people don't like to talk about bad experiences in the funeral industry, that word doesn't get around because it is a taboo subject, that a number of funeral directors get away with a bad behavior that in any other context, in any other business, they'd be run out of business because word of mouth would get around. So, be the first on your block when confronting the bad undertaker to say, no, I'm taking my business elsewhere.
Yeah. We have an email question from a listener, and this is someone who is thinking about cremation for mm-hmm. himself or herself. But the question is, are funeral directors offering a way to preserve some tissue in case it might be needed by our descendants?
No, not routinely in cremation. There is nothing organic left after cremation, no DNA. It's all 100% mineral. That's not built into the system. I think I think there are DNA banks that provide that mm-hmm. service at great expense. Mm-hmm. It's stuff that you can find online. If you have some interest in preserving a piece of DNA for to tell future generations what worked and what didn't in your own cellular structure, then you're kind of on your own. There are, I think I've encountered at least a couple of DNA banks, private banks, that will give you that option. But it's not built into the funeral directors are about dealing with the here and now, and so it's not really their game to provide a way to bank for the future.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign on line 2. Good morning.
Morning. In terms of biodiversity and funeral arrangements, it's fairly recent that there has been cremation here up into the 60s probably. Do you have cremation facilities that are also visitation facilities where the people can be there while the body moves into the crematorium? And the other question I have is, how do funeral homes work with bodies that are destined to go to scientific research?
I'll start with the last question. I actually never encountered, I encountered human donations as a medical student and learned anatomy that way. In the time I was at the funeral home, it never came up that somebody was donating to an anatomy lab or, whole body donation. Certainly plenty of them came to us after organ donations. But I think it's still a rare thing. The procedure generally is when somebody dies, they're put in the care of the family officially, who then appoints a funeral director to deal with the body. If it's going to a medical school, then the funeral home it's their job to deal with the logistics, and then it becomes a logistical problem to solve, getting the body there, getting the paperwork done, and so on and so on, but they act as an agent. On the question of cremation, yeah, you know, you would think in the UK it's routine that people go to the funeral at the crematorium, and they see, you know, they're not so, their tradition is not so much viewing of the actual body like it is in North America in an open casket, but they are basically there on hand in the very facility where the body will be cremated, whereas in North America that tends not to be the case. Now, Neil Bardell, who I worked with, was trying to adopt the UK model to his own crematorium, in fact inviting people, or at least giving them the option of viewing the body before the cremation and actually seeing the casket, or in our case, people tended to be cremated in cardboard boxes, to see the box go right into the retort, which is what they called the oven. In his mind, it was the same thing as seeing a body go into the ground in a cemetery, and we do tend to gather around the grave and to see the, you know, as a last gesture to see the body go into the ground. Why not do it at the crematorium? But I think for whatever reason, we're still at the point where cremation is something that happens behind the scenes. It's a technical process. Neil saw it as the last disposition, the same as burial. But we're a long way before I think it's accepted. But it's a good question to ask, if it means something to you, to ask your funeral director, can I be there with the body as it goes into the retort? And a good funeral director, a caring funeral director, will find a way to make that happen for you, because it's what you want.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got a number of people waiting. Let's take another call now, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I had two questions. One is on the cremation. Do the bones decompose, or do they have to be ground up? And second, I was wondering if the author had seen the Japanese movie Departures, which is a recent movie, and in that it's a story of how they actually prepare the body in front of the family. They wash it, dress it. And I believe in that movie they did show people gathering around the crematorium and watching the body go into the crematorium.
Right, because it's a Japanese film, and so I'm talking about North American culture still has a hang-up about participating in cremation, that there is this need to create distance from the actual physicalness of death and the last disposition. I will watch Departures. I promise the planet. You have no way of knowing, but there was a call earlier. Somebody asked if I'd seen Departures, uh-huh. And I have a lot of people asking me about this film, and I haven't seen it yet, but I'm going to go see it. I'm going to get it on Netflix. This question about cremation, do the bones? No, the bone. What's left of the all the process over a couple of hours at very high temperature is to get rid of all organic matter. So in fact, it's the mineral structure of the bone that's left behind. And yes, they're ground down into a powder to make it easier for families to scatter, because you don't want to scatter bone pieces. That, too, is in the category of too much information or too much reality. So routinely they're but in that powder, in those 200 cubic inches is what we all tend to come down to, 200 cubic inches of powder, there's nothing organic. You can't catch anything from it. It's like rock. It's like sand. In the same way that you can't get a disease from picking up a handful of beach sand, it's purely inorganic.
And cremated remains are not human remains, and I suppose that also is a point of law.
Well, yeah, this is where it gets touchy, and it's a point of law depending on what state or province you're in. And I don't know, state by state, province by province, except for Manitoba, where it actually came down to a court having to decide, are cremated remains human remains? Because, well, it's a very long story, but Neil, my mentor and boss in this, was trying to maintain a scattering garden on his property, and the cemetery owners in Winnipeg were challenging him on this. Basically, they were saying that he was running a bootleg cemetery because he was putting human remains in his garden, and he wasn't paying the fees and perpetual care funds to run a cemetery. His argument was that cremated remains are not human remains, that the human remains go into the retort, but what comes out are mineral remains. It's a kind of a moot point in a way, and you can argue it back and forth, which is what the courts did, but in Manitoba finally decided that no, there's nothing human about cremated remains, and yet leave to us the decision whether they still have some sort of magic mystery and power to them, because certainly I'm not going to tell somebody who has an urn of cremated remains on their mantelpiece that they light a candle for every day that they're not human. They obviously represent a person.
Let's take another call, probably our last one this morning. Champaign, Urbana, line 3. Good morning.
Hi, any comments on the novel, The Loved One, by Waugh?
Mm-hmm.
The busy Hollywood VIPs who don't have time to meet will talk business at a memorial service because they all get together. And two, there's a web service that will send a last email to all your friends. So it's important to provide your trustee in your list of wishes with some passwords to all your accounts. Okay.
Okay, thanks for the comments.
Right. Yeah, I wonder how much deal-making was done at Tony Curtis's funeral the other day. And, to let your wishes be known, don't put it in your will, because they won't read that until after you're either cremated or buried. Passwords are a big deal. It's like leaving behind papers or valuables. Somebody needs to know how to wrap up your Facebook and Twitter presence and after you've departed.
Hmm. Wow. There we will leave it.
Okay.
Tom Jokinen, thank you very much for talking with us this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Tom Jokinen is a journalist. He is also the author of Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. The book is available in paperback from DeCapo Press.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This was a show that we first broadcast last fall in October. If you missed part of the show, maybe you'd like to go back and listen to some other past programs from Focus, go to our website. It's will.illinois.edu. While you're there, by the way, you might stop by the Focus page where you're trying to collect some comments, thoughts about the program. We've been on the air now 30 years, and maybe you have some thoughts about particular programs you've heard or guests or the program. You can go to our webpage, go to the Focus section. There's a place right at the top you can make comments. You could always send them to the email site if you want, will-talk@illinois.edu. You can write us 300 North Goodwin. You can do that as well. And in all, that's fine. We'd certainly like to have whatever comments you have on the show. And also, you want to be tuned here. We're doing a little project re-airing some very old interviews, programs that are not part of the web archive. We're calling this the Deep Archives series. We're trying to do it a couple of times a month. Some people have said they thought it's kind of interesting, and we'll have another installment of these next week on Friday. So you want to stay tuned for that.
Support for today's broadcast comes from 40 North 88 West, presenting the 6th Annual Boneyard Arts Festival, April 7th through 10th. With venues throughout the county, the festival, in conjunction with the local business community, is a celebration of music, dance, arts, culture, and theater. Information on this year's festival is at 40north.org.
WILL is your source for full-service news and information, and this year we're celebrating 40 years of NPR's award-winning news and 30 years of our talk show Focus. Our spring pledge drive begins Saturday, April 9th, and we're encouraging listeners to call in their pledge of financial support or give online now at willpledge.org.
That's it for Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look at commodity prices and how the contracts are faring today in Kansas City and in Chicago. Late in the morning here, 1 minute before noon, the May wheat contract in Kansas City is trading at 8.59 and a quarter, up 10 and three quarters. July, 8.70 and three quarters, up 11 and a half. Chicago, May, 7.32 and three quarters, up 7 and a half. July, 7.68 and a quarter, up 7 and a quarter. May corn, 6.64 and a half, down 6.5. July, 6.71 and three quarters, down 6.25. September, 6.26 and three quarters, down 4.5. And December, 5.96 and a quarter, down three quarters. May soybeans 13.57 up 8.5. July 13.67.5 up 8.25. August 13.68.25 up 10. September 13.55.75 up 5.75. May meal 356.60 up $3. May soybean oil 56.76 up 23. April live cattle 118.